Blog Talk Radio.
This is Yasa Sagonige, a seventh great grandson of Samanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. Folks, the scriptures say my people perish for lack of knowledge. We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Before he passed away in 1985, Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all 145 past Prophecy Keeper's interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keeper's does need money to continue to operate. We had a very close call at the end of last month. We almost didn't raise the funds that we needed to stay here on Blog Talk Radio. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look. OCO, Ginalee, this is Blue Otter coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the Cherokee Nation. Hello, everybody. This is your old friend, Will Bluewater, coming to you from an undisclosed location deep in the backwoods of Tennessee. I'm acting all secret because our guest tonight is really heavyweight. Anyway, without further ado, Barry Tomish, nobody can introduce you like you can, so go ahead, please.
In this world of Israeli politics, I was a major celebrity, primarily because I put out a book called Who Murdered Yitzhak Rabin? It eventually was translated to 7 languages. It made number 1 in Israel. I was a celebrity there. No fooling around, mostly because I've got that entirely right. My book, Who Murdered Rabin, I don't have to change a word in it. After all these years, I got it right. Now, that made me kind of a political celebrity in Israel, but also in the States, where it was published and was, well, it was reprinted in the Jewish press, and you've got Orthodox Jews by the hundreds of thousands reading this book. It was a big deal. Now, it's the only thing that I can say made the top of the Israeli best-selling charts. But I had 4 other books translated into Hebrew, and they're far more conspiratorial, if you can believe that. Rabin was knocked off, not by this wild man who got a gun and shot him in the back. Rabin was knocked off in a plot organized by Shimon Peres. That is the president of Israel. He's a serial murderer. Rabin wasn't the first. Well, his underlings were the bodyguard Yoram Rubin, who actually shot him, and the head of the Secret Services at the time, his name was Carmi Gilon, he organized the shooting by his man, let's put it that way. I got this darn right, and this book, it was not ignored in Israel. It was the biggest darn scandal going there. I was front page news there for years. Now, that's my background. Now, to get Who Murdered Rabin, I'll tell you a foreground so I don't have to do this after we start being interviewed by the latest events. You go to lulu.com, that's www.lulu.com. You'll see a search box, write in my name, Chamish. It'll take you to all my books. Rabin is sold in a very expensive color version. Don't buy it. Buy the black and white version. And you'll see that, really, I wrote one of the great conspiracy books of all time. And I use that term because there really isn't another proper term. Rabin was murdered in a conspiracy to get Peres into power. That was the Rabin assassination. That's who I am in Israel. And eventually it got very dangerous for me. Very, very risky to live in Israel. I was in the hospital, a month out of 3. I had a deadly stroke and then a near-deadly car accident, and I was treated like garbage in the hospitals. It's a long story, but I decided my time had run out. I have not got a prayer of living for long in Israel. They deal with people who open their mouths and are a threat to them like any other mafia in the world. There is a slight difference between the left and the right, not very much. It's less than you have in the States, which is almost nothing. But what it comes down to is the right are a teensy bit more concerned about dealing with Jewish lives. The left will knock off whoever you are, left, right, Jewish, Arab. They don't care. They just knock off. The political murders in Israel. Now, this is a subject I can go through at length, but I'm not going to scare your audience. It is very dangerous to become especially a right-wing political figure in Israel. They will kill you, and they've killed off the lot.
Well, let me interrupt. The reason why I found out about you is I've got another friend who had a run-in with, as I recall, the Trigger Man in... This guy infiltrated a group that my friend was involved with called the Autonomous Authority of Yesha, and they were trying to establish an authority.
What was it called?
The Authority of the Autonomous Authority for Yesha.
So never heard of it.
And this guy...
It sounds like a Secret Service operation.
No.
It doesn't sound real.
Well, you know who Magan Ben-Yosef is?
No.
Okay, he was... he's at Torah-Voice.org, and he was an American who went to Israel as a journalist. He worked for Middle East TV for a while, and then he went to work at the Jerusalem Post. And while he was there, he was involved with the he found the cave that Vental Jones eventually excavated and got the temple incense out of. But anyway, he was involved with trying to establish a political authority on the West Bank, and his group was infiltrated by the guy who was the trigger man, and the guy turned out to be...
What are you talking about? The trigger man was Yoram Rubin. He didn't infiltrate anybody. Now, you might be discussing Avishai Raviv.
No, yeah, Avishai, yeah, that's who it was. Sorry. Well, that's kind of how I came to know who you are, and because of the coincidence. And
well, you can go on with your story. Avishai Raviv infiltrate this organization, which, by the way, I've never heard of. Let's not make it like it was a power. It was not a powerhouse.
It wasn't.
Nonetheless, if Avishai Raviv was there, who exactly did he infiltrate? What was he doing? I need to know this. This is news to me.
I can just send you an email address. I can't remember all the details. They were a small group trying to do something back in the 90s, and it didn't get far, but long story made short, my friend knew this guy, had actually met him and been involved with meetings, and they got shut down, because of this, and I'm familiar with the intrigue.
Not enough.
Oh, I'm sure.
Not enough. This is rumor, and by the way, if this person, whoever he is, wants to write me and tell me what exactly Raviv did to his group, it would help my cause a whole lot.
Sure, sure. I'll give you these contact details later. But
all right, fair enough. Again, if you know Raviv, and it sounds to me like you've got just basically scratching the surface.
Yep.
What was going on was a lot more serious than that. He was urging people to, he was urging them to kill. And in more than, I can think of two instances, people who knew Avishai Raviv too well, died mysteriously, pushed off buildings in one case. And the point is, it's a very ugly scene, but you're not describing it in the detail it deserves.
I'm sorry.
I left a gaping gap for a reaction, but I didn't get it. Oh, I'll go into the modern, what's going on right now. Now, knowing your listeners, and I don't know how many there are, I hope we get an audience, and I hope this recording is not the last time I'm on, but let's just look at what is going on in Israel today, and I'll try and put some background. I have much easier radio shows where people know me, and they've been following me, so in this, I've got to start from nowhere. Look, put it simply, I'm going to do it in lay language, elementary school language, but let's get to what Migron is, and what is about to happen in Israel. Now, Migron is a settlement in Samaria. There was a decision by the Supreme Court, not the government, mind you, the Supreme Court, and we'll talk about what the Supreme Court in Israel is, and it's not about justice. It is really working against most of the population of Israel. Well, they ruled that Migron would be evacuated. Evacuated is the word for bulldoze. It's, pardon me?
I just laughed because I've seen pictures.
Well, they come in the middle of the night with bulldozers. They pull the family out of their houses. Sometimes the dog is left behind. It doesn't matter. They just walk. Well, they just pummel in front of their eyes these people's homes. Straightforward. That's what evacuation is. It's a euphemism for destruction. Now, what the court said is go and destroy Migron. And they went nuts, the people there. They've been there for years. The land is nobody's Palestinian land. They were just picked out of the blue. I mean, really, they were picked, well, they were picked ultimately to break down Israel's, whatever remains of Israel's unity. You have Jews coming in, the IDF, coming in with bulldozers to force Jews out of their houses. You're not going to like the IDF very much. And we'll talk about this shortly, my interview with Tamar Yonis, and remind me about that. But what happened was there was another decision. The government decided to go against the Supreme Court and delay talk of evacuation till 2015. There was another case where the government, the law of Israel, all right, the ultimate authority, higher than the Knesset apparently, decided to give the IDF until August 1st to destroy or evacuate Migron. Now, just, I'm going to read straight from the decision. This is from, well, you've never heard of him, Asher Grunis. He's the Supreme Court president. Corrupt, corrupt, corrupt. Here's what he ruled. This is a necessary component of the rule of law to which all are subject. As part of Israel's values as a Jewish and democratic state. Now, look what he adds. Migron residents may harbor justified resentment against the state and its authorities. Justified? Well, of course they're going to harbor resentment. Their homes, $200,000 of their lives were bulldozed in front of their eyes. You can bet they're going to be resentful, but justified coming from the ruling means they should be. Now, here is why this settlement, Migron, was ruled to be bulldozed. Here's the ruling. The court president said that the state had made it clear that can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, the fuzziness went away. The state had made it clear that all along that settlements cannot be built on private Palestinian land. Who says it's private Palestinian land? There is no one holds the leash. There is no proof that it's Palestinian land. It was vacant land. No court on earth would say that it was owned by Palestinians. But the Supreme Court of Israel, well, that's what I'm going to just read what they said in their ruling. As the state has made clear, no body is authorized to permit the establishment of a settlement on private land. That's their ruling. That means that these families and their children, and they have lots of children, they're all going to be huddled under blankets in the middle of the night watching their house being destroyed. Now, I'm going to quote this ruling again so you understand what Israel is. Israel is not a place of democracy. It's a mafia state. That's what it is. But, Lord, if you're right-wing or religious, the war that's being fought against you, here is the ruling continued. As the state has made clear, no body is authorized to permit the establishment of a settlement on private land, and then they cite the former Supreme Court president, her name was Dorit Benesch, on the original ruling. Now, look, I'm starting new with your listeners. Dorit Benesch in 2007 took $20 million from the Ford Foundation in one check, and she handed out to very anti-Israeli Jews, pro-Palestinian Jews. She is part and parcel of this war that's being fought against anyone in Israel who is not playing ball with their destruction. But here is what she wrote in 2011. We can only wish that the residents of the outpost will come to their senses and agree to accept their duty not to appear as lawbreakers, and that they will settle on any other state that the state deems fit to allow them. Wow, look at that. They're not coming to their senses and agreeing to be homeless. And they don't really care if they appear to be lawbreakers. What you've got is her message is just pick up and move. That's it. We have decided we're going to bulldoze your houses. On behalf of whom? Now, here's where it gets really profound and really deep, and I'm not sure I want to dive into this right now. The on behalf of whom business, it is not on behalf of Jews. There is a very, very serious agenda working against Israel, and it's working like a charm. Now, I could go and actually do this, and who knows? Maybe we'll find time, and maybe I will. But she is, the Ford Foundation is paying her to make decisions that are a nightmare for the residents of Judea and Samaria. And we're going to talk about what that means, because I wrote a book called Bye Bye Gaza, where I was in Gaza all the way through the evacuation. And I interviewed and I did, well, I saw it, and I wrote a book about it. Again, you get that book, Bye Bye Gaza, on lulu.com. That's L-U-L-U.com. Write my name in the search box, C-H-A-M-I-S-H. That's how you spell Chamish. Get the cheap book. Don't get it in color. Too expensive. Look, what's coming up is Gaza all over again. Now, here's what's going to happen from this point on. The army, which really we're going to talk about how many enemies are out there and how deadly is their threat to Israel and how very likely they're going to succeed. Israel has got to face up to a threat never ever. Look, there are 200,000 missiles pointed at Israel. This comes from the head of the IDF intelligence division. His name is Kohavi. It surprised me. It was about 75,000 more than my estimates had given me.
Well, and these are the Katusha-type rockets?
No, they're Grads. They're all kinds of rockets.
Okay.
They can hit anywhere in Israel with full force. They've got warheads. They've got biological and chemical warheads. What are you talking about? No one shot a Grad in the last 10 years.
Okay. I thought you were talking about the small rockets that like Hamas would shoot from.
Yeah, 10 years ago.
Right, okay.
All that's gone. You don't have these rockets anymore. You have a genuine, look, the Grads cause plenty of trouble. You don't want one landing on your head. And plenty of Israelis died when a Grad somehow found its target. But these are guided missiles. My goodness, you're not talking about a pipe with some explosive in it, and let's see what happens. You're way behind the times if you're talking Grads.
No, I wasn't. I was talking Katusha.
Well, they are. You know, you said Grad. Katusha, you can be sure of. Lots and lots of Katushas, but what you've got is, well, you've got Russian missiles. You've got You've got North Korean missiles came through Iran. You've got missiles in Lebanon, Syria, which is allied with Iran. If we'll talk about this business about if Israel attacks Iran's nuclear facilities, that's a joke. The next day, Israel doesn't exist if that happens. You've got in Lebanon a good, well, the figures are 50,000 rockets with Hezbollah. You've got in Syria, the figure is close to 90,000 rockets. In Hamas, you've got another 20 or 30,000. And then you've got Iran. Well, I'm not going to talk about the potential missile throwers, like from Egypt and so forth. That's for the near future. But in the present day, Israel's enemies have 200,000 rockets, according to Kochavi, aimed at the country, and they can hit anywhere. The days when little pipes terrorized a little town like Sderot are long gone. The missiles are now hitting Beersheba. They're hitting Rishon-LeZion. And the army is going to be wasting its manpower doing Gaza all over again. The settlers are up for a fight. To them, it may even turn into a fight to the finish. Now, the game is played with an awful, awful lot of infiltrators into the right. The famous one was Shapiro, Rav Shapiro. He was the Gaza infiltrator. He got the youth in Gaza's yeshiva to do everything but defend Gaza. And again, that's in my book, Bye Bye Gaza. Then you have Itamar Ben-Gvir, who broke up the only demonstration to stop the IDF. It was run by the women in green, along with a couple of members of the parliament. What's his name? It doesn't matter, Ariel. It doesn't matter. He broke them up. The major infiltrators were Itamar Ben-Gvir and Amiram Shapiro, Rabbi Shapiro. And what you've got is the youth of Gaza follow their rabbi like idiots. And I wrote this up. I was at the rally where the rabbi tells them to go far from Gaza. We're not going into Gaza. We're not going to disturb the soldiers. They would never, ever evacuate 10,000 people. They're Jews. He was a traitor number one. And I've got a lot of information about Rabbi Shapiro. Rabbi Shapiro was a first-class pedophile, and they caught him. And there were women in Ma'ariv, there were dozens of them, a good dozen, without exaggerating, a good dozen, who described how Rabbi Shapiro attacked them and touched them and did all kinds of inappropriate behavior. And he was leading the youth of Gaza to fight the IDF. Listen, the odds were thousands to one because people are very, very stupid. And they're very, very easily led into disaster. And they don't know what a real fight is. And they will not fight for their own welfare. This went on in Europe. It's now happening in Israel. The dumbest people in the world are the settlers. They don't come any dumber. All right, now that's Bye Bye Gaza, where I covered for a couple of infiltrators, and these settlers went with their hands in the air. They just surrendered like they would to the Nazis. And that's about to happen again for Migron. You got the settlers considering it an outright outrage, and they're right. You got the army now wasting its manpower on evacuating them, on using psychological warfare, on playing dirty tricks. And while Israel's enemies are very close to destroying the country, very, very close, the army is wasting its time on Migron. That's the story in short. of what is going to be happening this summer. And they won't necessarily show up on August 1st. What they did in Gaza is they faked it a lot. There were a lot of demonstrators, so the army would make like they were going in and then turn back. And this happened once, this happened twice. First time there were 50,000 people, the next time 40,000. Until the day of the evacuation, there was no one there to defend the settlers. And, by the way, the settlers didn't prepare for them. They didn't prepare. Well, there was no place for them to even put a tent up. There was no water. There were no supplies. There was nothing for a demonstrator who wanted to save Gaza. Nothing. It was all cleaned out. And, again, I'm going to say I like the settlers personally. I love the people of Gaza. They came to hear me speak. In one case, there must have been 700-800 people in the auditorium. I went there week after week trying to tell them. I said, what is going on? I see army jeeps in your settlements. Get them out of there. Block them. Block your homes. Get rid of these soldiers. They're your enemy. They're going to take you out of your homes. That's what they're planning to do. And you're letting them drive free of charge in your settlements? There was no talking to these people. They were cowards. Out there, cowards, and they ended up out of their homes with no compensation. None. It's been years now. They're not resettled. Their children, well, they are not good children. You take children out of a settled home where you had values, and you throw them into really tents, trailers, wherever they could throw them, as cheap as possible. These kids rebelled against their parents who were cowards. They should have rebelled against themselves. They were just as much to blame as the parents. But they let their homes go down the drain, and they're about to do it again in Migron this summer.
That's a shame. That's a real shame. Well, to give you a little bit more background on how I found out about you is this friend of mine was approached by right-wing rabbis and Jewish settlers who were opposed to a Palestinian state in Judea, Samaria, on biblical grounds. And this organization he was involved with was infiltrated from the start by Avishai Raviv, who was later implicated in the assassination plot. And there was a dirty tricks campaign. And this eventually led to the arrest of my friend. He was thrown in the Russian compound for a couple of weeks and treated very poorly, and eventually told to leave. He was an associate of Brit Am, and trying
of
to get
what?
States Brit Am.
Well, it would be Brit Ham, but what is Brit Ham?
It was trying to get to stimulate interest from stateside people and non-Jewish Zionists to begin populating Judea, Samaria.
Oh, don't be silly. That never had a chance to begin with.
Yeah,
you're talking that he came from there. They probably got rid of him in 2 weeks. He was a troublemaker. Look,
yeah,
I'm talking about something that is homegrown, Israeli-born. These are Israelis. They moved to Judea and Samaria because their government told them to. This was 35 years ago. You've got a situation where some guy comes from the States and really is so outside the real picture. It's amazing he lasted 2 weeks. And I would be amazed if Avishai Raviv spent more than a day there. I'm talking about he was involved with killing Rabin. He set up Yigal Amir. He set up a plot eventually for Paris, but was it was Raviv. Raviv went through Carmi Gilon, the head of the Shabak. Carmi Gilon hired a new bodyguard. They fired Rabin's bodyguard that night, the night of the assassination, brought in Reuben, and he shot Rabin. This was complicated stuff. What you're talking about is really read my books and dive into the situation. You're talking about a guy who opened his mouth once too much, and he was thrown out of the country. I'm talking about Israelis.
Basically, yeah, that's true. He was trying to.
What was his real name? I know he wrote me.
Del Griffin.
Say it again.
Del Griffin.
I know him. Don't take this seriously. This is, I'm talking about a real country about to be really destroyed.
Yeah.
And a guy coming from the States with a big mouth wasn't even, it was a nuisance. At best, it was a nuisance. What you've got going on in Israel is a real country about to be wrecked. Now, look, I'm going to give you an example of this. Now, you may or may not know what the Iron Dome system is. The Iron Dome is, I'm amazed it works. It's an anti-missile battery. The Iron Dome system is it's hitting about 85% of the missiles it can get to. Which means,
well, that's better than the Patriot system they had back there in 91, which is not,
it hit nothing.
Yeah.
That's certainly true. This is and it's a little less. The Patriots were like $2.5 million every time you shot one. I know what I'm talking about. I was in the anti-aircraft division of the Israeli Air Force. I also shot missiles. In one case, in the Lebanon War, at real airplanes. I know what I'm talking about. This is a major improvement. But neither here nor there, it still needs 15 seconds to target the missile. And a lot of cities in Israel are 7 seconds away. You hit Ashdod, the missile's there in 7 seconds. It's a problem. But neither here nor there, it costs $100,000 each time you send a missile against a missile. The missiles cost maybe $5,000. It's just a tube with some explosive in it and a nasty warhead. But they do terrible damage. Nonetheless, not the point right now. The point is that they're getting better and better with every operation. Right now, the missiles are falling in Ashdod, in Ashkelon, in Beersheba. The figure is that 1 million Israelis are living in terror from missiles. It's more than that. Beersheba's got to have 250,000 people. Ashdod and Ashkelon together is close to that. You've got yourself, southern Israel is now, everyone there is living under justified terror. Now, we'll go into that very shortly. What you've got to deal with is that the Iron Dome system, this week, by the way, for the first time, was positioned in Tel Aviv. Now, look, what the IDF spokesman said, I'll translate this. The Iron Dome system is in the process of operational reception. That's how they translated Kabbalat Mitzayit. Who knows what operational reception means? All right? You can say it simply. It's being set up. All right? Within the framework of this process, the process being operational reception, the battery is periodically positioned in various locations across the country. Currently, the system is positioned in the greater Tel Aviv area as part of the operational plan. Wow. No scaring Tel Aviv residents with that explanation. What you've got is the next round, or the one after, it doesn't matter, Tel Aviv is going to be hit. Now, you remember there was a war in 2006. Just after I left Israel, and I didn't leave voluntarily. I really just got the hell out of there. I was in and out of the hospital, accidents, strokes, you name it. It was a terrible situation. And I left Israel until there's a government that actually people vote for and represents them. That will never happen, I guess. But after 33 years, I left Israel, and the war broke out. Now, in 2006, never forget this, Israel lost the war. It was a 34-day war, against Hezbollah. Hezbollah sent how many missiles into Israel? A good 10,000, if not more, over 34 days. All of northern Israel had a way out. A car, anything. They all left. Northern Israel was empty of people. Hezbollah disrupted Israel's life completely, and they carried on after the war. Israel didn't do a thing to stop Hezbollah, not a thing. Now, what you've got is we've got a lesson what happens when real missiles land. When real missiles land, people are not happy that they landed. Not happy at all. Now, I'm taking information right now from the Jerusalem Post, which I rarely do. But I accept that this is a rational explanation, although names are not dropped, and the Jerusalem Post has not the greatest reputation for trustability. But nonetheless, they had a major, major story. And the IDF is debating whether sporadic rocket fire is enough of a justification to launch an operation against not Lebanon this time. Hezbollah has been very nice. They haven't shot off their missiles. This is Hamas. Now, justification. Not 3 weeks ago, in mid-March, in 4 days, over 300 rockets were shot at southern Israel. 300. Try and imagine, where do you live?
In the United States.
No, I know you live in the States. Where do you live?
Tennessee. Central Tennessee.
How would you feel about 300 rockets landing on your town?
Well, there's only about 30,000 people here, so it would be mass chaos.
No, I think you want to push it up to like a Beersheba where you've got 250,000 people to make the example. Why is the IDF debating? No country on the face of the earth will take the shutdown. Well, let's talk about what this is doing to the people of southern Israel. As people don't seem to understand what happens. Look, when I wrote Bye-Bye Gaza, I predicted that as soon as Israel is out of Gaza, you're going to see mortars and rockets like crazy. The Gush Katif settlements were a chokehold on Gaza and prevented outbreaks of violence. Once the Jews left Gaza, well, it was just a matter of time. Out went the PLO, in came Hamas, and, well, there have been about 8,000 rockets landing on Israel since mid-2005, since the pullout. Last year was a quiet year. There were only 680 rocket launches. That's two a day, all of southern Israel. A million residents. Now, I think it's more. I think they're covering this one up. I think it's probably closer to 1.5 million. But it's spreading. These residents live in terror, in permanent terror. Well, it dies down for a few weeks, and then it's up again. When you go outside, you could be blown up. When you go to the movie theater, it can be blown up. When you get in your car, it can be blown up. There is no security. And, well, when these rockets start, needless to say, schools are closed, workplaces are closed, parents have to stay home with their kids. This is what, well, as I said, mid-March, that was 3 weeks ago, Israel had 300 rockets, and all of this happened to them. Everyone stayed home. Everyone was terrified to leave their house. They stayed in shelters. A rocket goes through a roof, obviously. You stay in hot, smelly shelters with neighbors you hate. Look, Sderot was the town close to Gaza. In the days when they were shooting off these very primitive weapons. Shirokov. I'd say of the 8,000 rockets, half landed on Shirokov. Now there's an analysis of the effect of all these rockets on Shirokov. 45% of the children under 6 have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm amazed it's only 45%. All right, but that's what this statistic says. A big deal, because 41% of their mothers and a third of their fathers also suffer from stress disorder. That means these households are very hard to live in. Now, these kind of statistics are now being replicated everywhere in Israel, in Ashdod, in Ashkelon, in Beersheba, throughout the kibbutzim, all through southern Israel. The children are nuts, and so are their parents, quite frankly. What you're getting in Israel, look, no other country would put up with this kind of showing. None. The idea, this was the Jerusalem Post article that made me read it. They're debating whether sporadic rocket fire is enough of a justification to launch an operation. 304 days is sporadic? No country would take.
Gee.
Well, we're making our point slowly. We're now talking this week. We're not talking old news. Now, how did this happen? I mean, really, how did it get to the point that Israelis who used to really stand up for the country, well, they used to. Now they run into shelters and they hide behind iron domes and they don't fight anymore. But you have to remember that it was the Kadima Party under Ariel Sharon. He's the one that pulled the Jews out of Gush Katif, out of Gaza. It was Sharon. It was pure treachery. And I could talk to them because they killed Sharon. Same guys who killed Rabin, the same Yoram Rubin, the same Shimon Peres, the same gang who killed Rabin. Well, he's not dead. He's waiting for a brain transplant. But he may as well be dead. And you have to look that once the Jews pulled out of Gush Katif and the rockets started, Sharon said the rockets, this is a quote from him, are not that bad. They're okay. Shimon Peres, now Peres is just, I could do a whole 2 hours on Peres. What you've got for a president of Israel despises Jews, despises them. And he is a mass murderer, and the Israeli people, once again, just don't object that a mass murderer, the man who murdered Rabin and Sharon, is their president. You can't make Israelis wake up. You can't do it. And believe me, I tried. I know what I'm talking about. It almost killed me. But what did Shimon Peres accuse the southern Israelis, quote, of stoking hysteria? And then he went on to talk about the rockets. What's the big deal? What you've got is Israel's leadership, who I say again, and you have to get used to it. If you understand my work, you have to understand they're not working for the Jewish people. They're working against them. They're working for outside sources. It's a very nasty situation. Peres is up to his ears with the Vatican. And again, I can talk about that and there is no problem. Sharon was up to his ears with the Council on Foreign Relations. Outsiders are making life in Israel unlivable. The people of Israel got acclimated to the idea that life can be lived with rocket fire, because that's what their leaders told them.
Wow. Yeah. Well, what? You know, there's a lot of people here in the United States that, you know, they're millions of them Christians, love Israel, they want to support Israel, but
they've got this Pollyanna-ish idea of what's going on over there. And
well, they're supporting a place that doesn't exist. They've got a fantasy land that somehow fits into their version of biblical prophecy, and it's completely nothing to do with biblical prophecy, what's going on in Israel. What you've got are leaders that truly you want to, I'll talk about this coming up since the first show, and I won't be shy. I'll just talk about what's coming up next.
No, absolutely. Let us know, because this is, you know, I've always been a muckraker and an iconoclast, and I want people to know the truth about what's going on and, you know, how they can concentrate their efforts, or whether it be
you mean to say that you
were
rucksacks?
No,
you were a ruckmaker.
Ruckmaker. No, a muckraker. That's someone who, that's an old word.
I know what it is. It's okay.
Okay.
Now.
Because you're one of them, too.
No, I'm not. I just report the facts, and very dryly.
Right, okay.
Look, my book, don't kid yourself about this. No one has criticized, I mean, no one has provided an actual criticism with mistakes. My book stands the test. All my books, they stand the test of time. I'm very, very careful in my sources and in my quotes. And I knew when I was in Israel, I was the only one people could turn to. What a series of interviews I did for my books from people who were terrified, not always giving their names, but they sought me out. And well, look, let's go backwards to today before we go into that scene. As I say, I've got a lot of books. Bye Bye Gaza is very relevant to what's coming up in Migron. If you read that, you'll find out what the IDF is about to do. Now, I'm going to tell you about Tamar Yonah. Well, I've got this memorized, or it came back to me. Tamar Yonah runs a show on Israel National Radio. Now, I like her a lot. We've been friends for the longest time. In fact, we were friends with Rabbi Marvin Antleman. Oh, I don't want to do that now. He was one of the people who saw that the Israeli government was taken over. I'll talk about Rabbi Antleman in some further show, I guess. But the important point with Tamar Yonah is a popular radio show. And she was on my show. I had a nasty year, I want everyone to know. A very nasty year. In January, I had a quintuple bypass.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, you didn't know that?
No.
Oh, I send you my stuff. All right.
Well, I may have forgotten.
No, it's not the kind of thing. My readers were very supportive of me. And it wasn't all bad. And they said, I'm going to live another 30 years, and they caught it just before a major cardiac. And it's a long story. But during that time, I've got this radio show on First Amendment Radio, and it turns out I'm the most popular host. And I didn't want to give it up, but I couldn't talk in those days. I mean, I have this congestive heart disease that I ended up back in the emergency room. I had liquid on my lungs. I couldn't get a word out. So I got guest hosts. Some were good, some were terrible. But for about a month and a half, I couldn't do a show on my own. I couldn't speak. And so I had a guest host who invited Tamar on. I've been on her show many times. And she phoned me in the hospital. She's a good friend. Now, Tamar, my guest host, by the way, I couldn't get her to direct one question to Tamar, so I took over the show. Now, Tamar was a wonderful interview until she started bragging about her son. Her son, she says, is a major in the IDF, and she's so proud of her officer's son. And I said to her, are you nuts? Are you nuts? You're holding that as a badge of honor? You should be ashamed of yourself. What you got, she bragged that she could see me run from her kitchen window. And I said, your son's army is going to pull these people out of their homes in the middle of the night, your neighbors. I said, you got to be out of your mind to brag about that. It's a disgrace he's in the army. And I said, look, if she bragged that the settlers have the highest proportion of officers in the IDF, and I said, well, the settlers are nuts because they are pulling themselves out of their own homes.
Wow.
Well, that's exactly what's going on. It's a disgrace to be in the IDF today, an utter disgrace. Now, what you've got, and I'm saying that, my daughter is in the IDF, and I'm very proud of her, but she's not an officer, and she won't direct anybody. And if she is told to get involved in this Migrant evacuation, I hope she'll be brave and just tell them to go suck rocks. In the name of an evacuation, if you're an officer in the IDF and you're from the settlements, you tell them, I will not accept or obey any orders from the IDF until this evacuation business starts. That's it. And there's no other policy that will work to save their homes and to save their lives. And I told her this over and over again. If you support the IDF, you're supporting the day when they will come to your door and your son will evacuate you from your home. Your home. He may not be there in person, but he'll be there. And until this is understood, and I, believe me, I hit her hard with this, and she didn't seem to understand it. She said, whenever there's a crisis, my son is ready to handle. I said, well, there's a crisis. They're about to evacuate Migron, which you can see through your kitchen window, and your son is going to be throwing your neighbors out of their house, out of their homes. That's the crisis. The Jews can't understand this. It's an utter disgrace to be in the IDF as long as these evacuations take place. An utter, complete disgrace. And I'm saying that as an IDF soldier who fought in a very serious war for the IDF, when the IDF represented the Jewish people. They no longer do.
What a shame.
Well, all of this is a shame. And it only gets worse. Now, we've done 1 hour. Do I get a break?
Sure. But I won't edit anything.
Funny you mentioned Del Griffin. He used to write me all the time. And he, this was many years ago, but when I say this to you, he was a nice guy, and I corresponded with him for the longest time. Believe me, he was no threat. All right, I'm putting this mildly.
He was trying to approach things from a prophetic angle.
It didn't work. It didn't work with the government. It didn't work with his neighbors. But neither here nor there, you brought up a name I hadn't thought about in a good 5 years.
Well, it was the day after he had a meeting with Yair David.
Yair David, who is Yair David?
He
never heard
picked up. He's Brecham.
Yair David?
He's a guy. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Who is he?
He's the titular head of Breed
Hall. Oh, my Lord. Oh, my God. I know Breed Hall, but they're nuts. They're the Anglo-Saxon, they're the English Jews. I know who Davidi is. He's a nutcase. They're the English. They're the ones that think that Israel is England and England is Israel. Oh, my goodness.
Well, no.
I know exactly who they are.
No, I know you do. We're talking about descendants of the Northern Kingdom that
that went out into, into the world.
Disappeared, and he says they went to England. No, this is just nutty stuff you're talking about. I'm glad we recorded this, though. I had heard of Breedham, and this guy is always attacking me, but he's minor. It doesn't matter what he says. He's got about two people reading him. All right.
Well, what happened is Dell got arrested and thrown in the Russian compound for a couple of weeks, and when he had been working at the Jerusalem Post, and when he was being interrogated, they didn't just have a file on him; they had a file cabinet on everything that he'd ever written, and you know, he'd been followed and shadowed.
And you're saying that's because of Davidi?
No, just because of the things that he was involved with. He got involved with some real white wing, you know, folks in the Shah's party, and I can't remember the name of the organization, but they were trying to respond to terrorist attacks by getting to what was going on, try to beat the police and the IDF there. You know, he
Shah's
just did a lot of crazy
that.
Stuff.
Shah's never had activists.
No, I'm not saying that, but he was involved with another organization. Who was that? Who was that rabbi that was murdered years and years ago? And he was a follower of his followers, and but he was involved in a lot of recent stuff.
No, he wasn't. We'll start up. He was involved with stuff that would get anybody thrown out of the country.
Well, he got involved. He got involved with. He knew Rabbi Andelman because. Rabbi Andelman had analyzed a sample of incense that was found in the cave that Dell discovered by accident because he was there covering the dig for the Post, and he went up on a mesa, and he happened to look down and saw something that caught his interest, and he felt a little bit of cool breeze coming out of a hole, and anyway, the hole was later excavated, and that's where they found Jones found the devil in.
Let's forget this topic. I know all these people. Wendell Jones was serious, by the way, and I think he was a very, very nice man, so don't get me wrong, but what you're talking about is Breedham. You're talking about, fringe is not the word. I hope this is recorded. This is actually good stuff to know. This isn't fringe. This is, if you don't have a citizenship, we're going to throw you out of here for this.
Right.
He would not be, they don't throw a lot of people out, but what you're describing is just, cruising for a bruise, and that's all. Now let me have a few minutes just to get my throat. This was a good thing to understand. I had forgotten about Buddha. I know these things exist, but they're of no consequence.
Sure. Go ahead and
all right, let me plug my website. Last thing I do. Do you want to just stay on the line? My website is BarryChamish.com. That's Barry and Chamish is CHAMISH.com. My books are at Lulu. www.lulu.com. Write in my name in the search box, CHAMISH, and get the cheap ones, don't get the color ones. Good. I get 7 minutes to clear my throat.
You bet.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Oh,
I'm
good.
Back.
Yeah, as that last stuff, keep in there. You remind me of things that. Well, I haven't thought about it in a whole long time.
Well, the other thing I'm involved with the Noahides and
That was Gendel. Gendel was a serious guy.
See, what happened is I had a earlier incarnation of this radio show back between 2003 and 2008, and I got involved. Well, I found out about the renewed Sanhedrin.
Oh, that's also Antelman. He was on the Renews. Right.
Right. Got in touch with Mikhail Baron, interviewed him, and then I interviewed Dell several times. And because, you know, Dell was basically from the same area and kind of the same area of the country and had a we had a lot of, I mean, we had even had similar friends. My mother was from Vicksburg, and Dell worked there. And we hit it off and worked closely for a while. And you know, I found out that, you know, there was a rub between Dell and you know, Rabbi Baron, and but because they were both involved with Yisrael Schneider. And you know, so I found myself caught up in. Yeah, he's seat number 21 on the Sanhedrin.
Oh, okay. I went to a few of their meetings to sell books.
And I don't know what's going on there, but even, you know, Mikhail Baron has distanced himself from. So, you know, I got caught up in all this stuff. And,
well, get caught up in what's really happening.
Yeah,
all
right,
you can roll and I'll be.
We're rolling. I'll just get it out here for.
What you described. Now, I want to make it clear. You know, Rabbi, stupid me, Wendell, not Rabbi Jones, Wendell.
Right.
I stayed with him for 2 weeks while I gave lectures in the Dallas area. He was a marvelous host. I know his daughter. She bought books from me. She is a.
Was that 2005?
Yeah. I'd say 2005. She is a genuine converted Jew. She's a true blue settler, lives near Jericho. She's a real thing. She's we got along just fine. Wendell and his wife and I all got along during that time. There is an issue, and it's a complicated one.
Let me ask you a quick question. Were you there when during Katrina, Hurricane
Katrina? I was in Israel. That's when Gush Katif was. Look, I wrote the shortest thing I ever wrote. I had this. I don't know where it came from me. I wrote this article, and then this is Gush Katif is right now being evacuated, and oh my goodness. Katif is K-A-T-I-F. Katrina is K-A-T-R-I-N-A. I said, take away the cat. And the message is, if rain, if you evacuate Gush Katif, you're going to see rain. And needless to say, I sent that out before there was any rain in New Orleans from Katrina. I don't know where that came from. I've never sent a two-line message, but a lot of people actually got it. Yeah, I was in Israel in 2005. I was covering. I was in Gaza. Well, I was there 2 days before the pullout, talking to rabbis, talking about the betrayal, talking about Rav Shapira and what he was doing to the youth. I was speaking there. I was preparing my book there. Yeah, I was there in 2005. Why are you asking, by the way?
Oh, just curious because Rabbi Baron was there in 2005.
Look, I don't
just
know
curious.
Him, but I do know Rabbi Antleman. Rabbi Antleman and I were on the phone. He phoned me, by the way. He wanted advice from me. Now, look, you have to understand, I didn't believe Rabbi Antleman's to eliminate the opiate for a long time. I could not conceive that Judaism was infiltrated in the 17th century by someone named Shabtai Tzvi, who created a false Judaism. Well, what it's called Sabbateanism.
Sabbateanism, that's right.
I'm going to plug myself again. If you don't read this stuff, you don't know where I'm coming from. I wrote a book, and it's considered one of my better ones, my best, actually. Shabtai Tzvi, Labor Zionism, and the Holocaust. Now, this title is telling the truth of what was done to Jews by labor Zionists. Shabtai Tzvi was an anti-Jewish Jew. He said everything in the Torah was right in the opposite sense. In other words, I always use this example. There are plenty of them. But do not kill becomes do kill. And that's a mitzvah. The Holocaust was a burnt offering. That is Rabbi Antelman's concept, that you had this Sabbataneism. It transferred itself to labor Zionism. And it led to the Holocaust to get in Israel. It's a very ugly and scary story. Now,
well, you know, listeners out there, you know, you need to understand, if you're not familiar, that there are large movements within Judaism that don't even believe that Jews should even be in Israel at this point. So you got a lot of
you don't have
things going on.
You've got left-wingers. These are Sabbateans.
Yeah.
You can call them large groups if you want. All right. Call them large groups. These are they don't even know they're being affected by the Sabbataneism. The Jewish left is a real problem for Jews. Real problem. Rabbi Antelman explained the story to me. I couldn't accept it. It was too, you know, there are some things that are too radical, even for a guy like me. The day that I accepted it was the day I woke up. There was a Sabbataneism. Labor Zionism, the founders of Israel, the Ben-Gurions, well, the needless to say, the Perez's, the Rabin's, the Golden Meir's, they're all from this Sabbataneism. And what Rabbi Antelman did was prove, now look, this is a separate subject that I may go into. Today I wasn't planning on it, but Turkey was the home for Sabbataneism. Shabtai Tzvi claimed he was the Messiah of the Jews on June 18th of 1666.
Right.
Big day in Jewish history. Shabtai Tzvi claims he's the Messiah. The problem is that Sabbataneism spread, all the books say this, and I always quote this, from Iran to Mexico, the Jews sold their belongings, a penny on the dollar. They climbed to mountains. They stripped naked and expected to be transported into the New Jerusalem, which surprised me. Half the Jews of the world.
That's right.
All right, I see we have.
That's what I read. Yeah, I've done a little bit of reading on this subject, and it's really concerned me because, you know, I wonder about, you know, how many Jews, particularly American Jews, you know, buy
None.
Into this.
Are you joking? Look, you have to understand.
But the political leaders of Israel are
know
that
well.
Into this.
Look, again. Oh my goodness, great! If we have to do this, it's a long, complicated talk. Put it this way.
Well, we can make it another show if you want to. I'd like to have you on at least once a month.
Once a month? I do once a week if you want.
Hey, let's do once
you
a week.
You want to do a subject once a week?
Sure.
I'll do Antelman. Look, this is a very serious subject. The Jews have been infiltrated. Their people have been infiltrated. Now, Judaism is very complicated. There are all kinds of movements. I don't care who a Jew is or what movement he belongs to. I don't give a damn, quite frankly. But nonetheless, there are all kinds of rivalries between the Haredim and the Nationalists. And without diving into it, the left are who controls Israel. Now, not who controls elections anymore. There hasn't been a leftist who won an election since 1974. Golda Meir was the last one. The Israeli people reject Sabbataneism totally, completely. And by the way, they know it is Sabbataneism or Frankism. There are plenty of the old-timers who know exactly what I'm talking about. The problem is I gave lectures in Hebrew. I gave many lectures on Rabin, hundreds of them. Shabtai Tzvi was just so difficult to to explain. It took me 20 years to believe, Rabbi Antleman, these people were not going to get the idea in one night.
Well, is it true that, that Zvi, I was reading that he actually
converted
to Islam?
Well, that's the whole point.
Islam.
He was forced to. Now, remember,
right.
The Turks got he was in Gaza. And by the way, that's significant. I'm not going to dive into that either. You'll find that the amount of knowledge over time is getting to my little brain, who just can't take it anymore. Gaza was the headquarters of Sipai Zvi. The Gaza operation, I'm not saying it was directly connected, but it wasn't irrelevant. What Sipai Zvi did was create a court that really ticked off the Sultan of the Ottoman Sultan, and he gave him a choice. He put a knife under his throat, told him, you convert or you die. So Sipai Zvi became Muslim. He was a coward. And by the way, I would not necessarily want that sword going through my throat either. I'm not sure I'm a coward. I've been in situations where more or less I'm not a coward, but put a knife under my throat and you'll see me saying, sure, I'll be a Muslim. What the hell?
Well, I kind of refer to myself as a thinking paranoid, so maybe you're...
Well, the situation was very straightforward. You convert or you die. And he did convert.
Yeah, right. So.
And most Jews abandoned him worldwide. They realized they'd been victims of a massive hoax, but not all Jews. There was a...
And this is amazing that there could be a worldwide movement in the 17th
century.
Well,
that's the Vatican. I don't want to dive into that. Only the Vatican has the agents and the power and the people. On another show, we'll talk about that. There is no question that Sipai Zvi was guided by the Vatican. You could not have spread that movement so quickly worldwide without... There was one organization with agencies in countries around the world. That was the Vatican. There was nothing else. There was no Methodist church, okay? You had the Vatican or nothing. So clearly, he had help. But the real point is that one group did not abandon Sipai Zvi. That was the Donma cult in Turkey. And they really took to him. I mean, they said that he converted because it was a message that we should all convert to whatever religion is in our state, but secretly we'll be Sabbateans. Now, this dogma, I've got all kinds of personal and not personal recollections. There were only 50,000 Jews in Turkey. I talked to a Turkish woman who said, we're very grateful you've given us a very free society. I said, come on, there's only 50,000 Jews. She said, nah, there's a couple of million, and we know who they are. And she's absolutely right. And I could dive into who was a Sabbatean and who gave it out. The fact of the matter is Turkey has got Jews who claim they're Muslims. They don't claim they're Jews. On weekends or wherever they gather, they claim they're Sabbateans. Now, what labor Zionism did is they went to Turkey. Ben-Gurion went to Turkey. I'm not going through this. This I'm going to read on and do well. The fact of the matter is the Donma are very powerful in Turkey under the surface. What you've got with Rabbi Antleman, let's go backwards. His book was called To Eliminate the Opiate. Look on the internet, you might find it. The fact is, I didn't believe it. The man was talking to me it was usually a Thursday night. He caught up on the news. I was real buddies with Rabbi Marvin Antleman, and I liked the guy. I mean, and I liked his family. I never met his son, but he had three gorgeous daughters who I became friends with all of them. The point is, I believed it after a while, but it's not something. And I'm tough. I don't buy silly. Between us, I don't buy prophecies. I buy facts. And the fact of the matter is there's something wrong with Judaism. And the only person on the face of the earth I knew who was trying to get to the bottom of it was Rabbi Marvin Antleman. There, I said it. That's the highest praise I can give the guy.
Yeah, I'm at crashrecovery.org/Antleman, and apparently it's a digest of To Eliminate
one
the
and
Opium,
two,
Volume
yes.
1, Volume 2.
Now, look, it's not easy reading, but he had an amazing influence on me. Well, I had an amazing influence on him. We were very good. Look, in my writing career, Rabbi Antleman took a liking to me, and I took a liking to him. And I met with his family, and we took a liking to each other. Two daughters I met, one was married and was living in Honduras or Costa Rica. The point is I met his family. It was more than just talking on the phone about Sabbateanism and him listening to my interpretation of events. We became buddies. My other buddy at that time was Joel Bainerman. I'm not sure if you know who he is. Joel Bainerman wrote the first book on the Bush family. It was called Crimes of the President. It came out the same year my first, I wouldn't call it anti-Israel, it was Reform Israel book. It was called The Fall of Israel. It came out in England the same time that his book, Crimes of the President, came out in the United States. This was before Oslo. And throughout Israel, we were co-editors of something called Inside Israel. We were the only ones digging into what the hell was going on. No one else was there. But in Hebrew, it's a different story. We got our sources from a real free press that existed in Israel before Oslo. It no longer exists in Israel. Straightforward. Boy, I could dive into the stories we exposed. But Joel Bainerman, look him up. B-A-I-N-E-R-M-A-N, that's Bainerman. We were partners, well, during the end of Israel. Basically, the end of Israel. That was the Oslo Accord.
Yeah, well, I'm reading this blurb about this book, and I'm going to have to get into it. Sounds like I'm finally going to get a good. I've been wanting a good education on
then
who did what
my
and
book,
with what.
My
and
lord,
who.
Go on to lulu.com.
My problem is, you know, my wife and I are living on one fixed income, and I just haven't had any money.
Well, you think to eliminate the opiates any cheaper than my books? Listen, what you've got is a different world out there. What they've been handing you is a bunch of baloney. Now, the real problem with Antleman, he was way ahead of his time. And I don't dare. You know, it's amazing I'm mentioning in this show. I was just going to talk about events that are happening now. Somehow your references got me to him, okay?
Well, and then I'm wondering, maybe on another show, you know, we could talk about Soros.
Nah, that's a separate subject. That's a Jewish traitor.
Okay.
That's just okay. An outright Jew who is putting his money into everything that can destroy Israel. I don't want to do that. I'll mention that. I'm not the expert in that, but I know a little bit. I'm talking about the Jews destroying Israel. That's what I'm the expert at. And let me tell you, when I moved to Israel, I didn't have a clue. Not a clue. It was just when Oslo changed everything. It was the end of the Israel I knew. They brought the PLO back. They armed them to the teeth. We were suddenly at war with our worst enemy. That's when I started listening to Rabbi Antleman. That's when Joel and I went to first gear. It's when our government sold the country out. And by the way, the sale will be final. There won't be in Israel very shortly. But I'm going to tell you what's preventing that. Let's go back to where we began, and I don't know how we got so far off that. Mind you, it's useful. It's good for the future. Now, let's go this week. Now, what's going on is, look, this crap about Israel attacking Iran. Any Israel that attacks Iran has got to be prepared. That day, it's got a missile war in its own territory. And abuse. One that will, well, listen, 200,000 missiles are aimed at Israel. Get rid of 50,000 of them in one day. You see what 50,000 missiles on an area, my goodness, of Connecticut does. Now, what you're talking about is Israel attacking Iran. You know, I've dismissed this because it's not, look, the Israeli military leadership have very, very few ways out. Very few. We'll talk about, I think I know what they're planning, and this is going to be very spooky, I think, for the show, but I'm going to mention it. But
well, I've heard they've canceled all leaves, you know, during Passover, and I mean, there's saber rattling at least going on right now.
It's more than saber rattling.
And Obama's.
What you're talking about is the Americans. I'm going to say this. The Americans leaked. Look, this is from the Israeli press and media, and I don't trust it as a rule, but there have been enough reporters out there. It started with Ynet, and then I went down the line, and I said, okay, this is crossing this. I'm going to take this seriously. As the Azerbaijan Republic is a very corrupt place, okay? Really, if you're into crime, that republic is the best. Apparently, Israel bought 4 air bases on Iran's northern border in the Azerbaijan Republic. Without diving into it, if this interests you, you dive into it. The fact is, if you've got a military operation and you've got 4 air bases, and, well, it's a heck of a difference between refueling in mid-flight and flying back to Israel, which is possible, but it's risky, hugely risky, and having an air base 350 miles from the nuclear facilities, this was supposedly Israel's big secret. We can bomb the nuclear facilities. Now, frankly, what I've been reading is saying that's not enough, that you've got facilities deep, deep, deep inside mountains. You'll need an infantry attack. The Air Force can do so much. Bunker buses can do so much. It won't work. That's the way I've been reading it. But nonetheless, a lot of damage can be caused by having an air base, 4 air bases in Azerbaijan. The Obama administration, according to, I'm going to say this again, every Israeli source said, and believe me when I tell you that I don't use rumors. Rumors cause trouble. It's very hard to dismiss them. I'm telling you the sources were good. That America leaked that Israel has bought the Azerbaijan Republic and has an ability to strike Iran. All right?
No, you say you felt that they
bought the entire republic. What's the big deal?
Really?
You give a few leaders a couple billion dollars, you think that's, listen, mafia is mafia. They deal with money. If you hand over big money, you get an air base.
Right.
Well, it's not around. It's out there everywhere.
Well, I heard about the air bases, but yeah. See, you're. That's why I'm talking to you. So if I'm going wild and acting like I'm not.
Well,
fully briefed
is that somebody
is, and we want to know.
Is trying to trip up. Look, again, I'm going to say this. Israel's options stink. And we'll go into what I think. I mean, I have reduced, how do I put this? When you've got no options, you have to, you get desperate, all right? Now, look, the American administration, I don't care who they are. I don't give a damn if it's Obama or Bush. If it's Bush older or younger or Clinton or Carter, they've all been anti-Israel, starting with Reagan. It's a long story. It doesn't matter who runs America, but in 1985, Shimon Peres did something very stupid that really ticked off America. Now, this is called the Pollard spy scandal. There was someone named Jonathan Pollard. Listen, he was a clerk. He had no access to anything. But it was a Robert oh, my goodness gracious. What's wrong with my memory? You excuse me. I went through surgery. Robert McLaren, he needed someone within the Reagan administration. Robert, come on, help me out.
I couldn't because I'm not familiar with it.
I'm ashamed of myself. I knew this stuff backwards. He ended up in an asylum, and they took care of him. Pollard was a nothing. He agreed to send material to the Israeli government. The prime minister then was Shimon Peres. The good stuff came to Robert I feel foolish.
Oh, it's okay.
It's a whole story.
Well, you know,
the point is that Shimon Peres took the best of the stuff. He found the info, the data, right from the U.S. Navy intelligence service that there was an operation to free hostages in Beirut by, again, giving them arms, giving the bad guys who kidnapped them arms. It was called Arms for Hostages. It later became called Arms for Hostages. Peres took advantage of this knowledge, and instead of saying, oh, Lord, we got to stop the Americans, they are ruining our future, they're killing our people, he said, what a great idea. Let's expand it. This became known as Iran-Contra. Now, I can go through how Israelis sucked in the Bush. Not Reagan. Reagan was, by then, almost shot dead. Bush had taken over. It's a complicated story. Bush met someone named Amiram near in the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, and they discussed the arms for hostages fiasco, and Amiram Neer warned him that we're dealing with radical elements and it's unsafe, and Amiram Neer, eventually Peres's,
and this is back when Bush 1 was the
CIA. He was vice president. What are you talking about? This was 10 years after that.
Reagan Bush. Okay, I got it.
Let me get back to where, in short, Amiram Neer was supposed to testify before the Congressional Committee on Iran-Contra. He had an accident in Mexico. This was Peres' ally in Iran-Contra. He was the only one killed in a small plane crash in Mexico. The point being that after the Bush administration barely escaped, Reagan. Reagan was not active. He was a figurehead. The man was not the administration Bush was. The Bush dynasty survived by the skin of its teeth over the arms for hostages crisis called Iran-Contra. It was all done by Shimon Peres. The whole thing. And after they escaped with, again, by the skin of their teeth, it was really close. A lot of people went to jail. Israel refused to send Paul's helpers, Abiam, Shela, and Rafi Khan, who actually sits in the Knesset today. It's all mafia. Running Israel is the mafia, but I got news for you guys. Running America is the mafia. This was one blackmail against America by Israel. It goes deeper than what I'm telling you, but Iran-Contra was Israel, Shimon Peres, taking Jonathan Pollard's information and blackmailing George Walker Bush. Eventually, that turned into Oliver North and Amiram Nir.
Yeah.
And eventually, that became Iran-Contra.
And down to this day, you know, because of all that, you've got the rumors.
You don't
FEMA
have that whatsoever.
And, you know, it isn't. And you've got the U.S. Army or the National Guard.
You don't have that from Iran-Contra. Don't mix them up.
Yeah.
They're not connected to Iran-Contra.
Yeah, this is what's being reported.
Oliver North was chosen to go fly to Tehran with Amiram Nir. You have to understand what Iran-Contra was. It was complicated. Very complicated. What you have is Iran at war with Iraq. They needed arms. They were short of arms. Israel agreed to supply them arms with Hebrew writing on it, defective, but nonetheless, Israel agreed to supply them with the arms they needed if they released the hostages. The hostages were released the day of Reagan's inauguration. To pay for, listen, you had this money from Iran. It went to the Contras. What happened is the money was laundered by Bank of Poland in Miami, and then was shipped to the Contras, who bought arms of their own and shipped heroin and God knows what else. And they defeated the ruling government of Nicaragua. This is called Iran-Contra. It's a very messy story, and it has nothing to do with FEMA camps. It has a lot to do with deceit. It has a ton to do with Israeli's government becoming too mafia for the Bush administration, and a decision. The last thing Bush did almost on September 17th of 1993, before Clinton took over, he met Rabin in Kennebunkport, Maine, and this was 92, I take it back, September 17th, 1992, and he told them, you're going to deal with the PLO, and you're going to give them a state within Israel's borders. That's what you're going to do. You're going to bring back the PLO. Now, to go and dive into who Rabin was and why he agreed to this, and what happened afterwards, the point is, in November of 1992, two Israelis, Hirschfeld and Pundak, I'm not going to go through all of Oslo and how that deception was foisted on Israel, but without Iran-Contra, the Bushes wouldn't have been so furious in Israel that they devised a plan to break the country apart once and for all and for good. The way was called Oslo Peace. Rabin started it, and he died because he opposed it. He saw it was a trap. Peres killed him so he could continue to bring Israel to its end. He is now the president of Israel. The whole thing is, and by the way, I have done 0.01% of all the lying that went behind Israel's end. Israel has not got a long time to live. Now, I'll go into that if you want to hear the worst of it. Well, we all want to hear the worst of it, don't we?
Well, we want
the truth, again, I've skipped the facts that will bore your listeners who have never heard me before. I've been very, I do shows with Dr. Stan twice a week, let's say. I'm very different with him. I assume his listeners know what I'm talking about. Yours don't. What you've got right now in Israel is a military, imagine you're on the board. Now remember, the board of the IDF, that means, major, well, let's say colonel all the way to major general. It's the very top few of the IDF. Right. You don't
general
have settlers.
Staff, right.
Again, this is what I told Tamar Yonah. You don't have any settlers on the general staff of the IDF. They get stopped at captain or major. Later on, again, you can use the word Sabbatean Jews or leftists. They're interchangeable. That's what you have at the top of the IDF. Now, they've got a situation, and here's what it is, and you try and sort this out. They must have one heck of a threat out there, or these 200,000 missiles. There would be an excuse, there would be a war, and it would put an end to Israel once and for all. Now, Israel would do some damage, but with all its airfields, well, let's just put it this way. If you have 50,000 missiles, let's say 10,000 of them landing on your airfields, you're not going to have a plane take off. These are guided missiles.
Well, let me interject something. I know you're probably not going to believe this, but just let me say this. Back in the early 1980s, I was a military officer in Oregon's National Guard Reserve, and I read a book, and this is relating to prophecy, and I know you're not a student of prophecy, but it was called Nostradamus Predicts the End of the World, and even the book title was a misnomer. But the author of that book said that that Nostradamus had predicted that there would be a great power. He called it Hesperia at that time, which became America. He said they would eventually become allies with the Russians, and this would cause an imbalance of power in the world. And he said that the poor, persecuted daughters of Babylon, referring to the Jews, would have their wings clipped, and this would be somewhere around the time when Islam would invade Europe, and a man named Albert would be on the throne in Monaco. So I started telling my friends in the guard, the wall's coming down. We're going to become allies with Russia. And,
well,
6 years
time.
Later, it happened.
I don't know why you weren't allies the time. Russia is meant to be your ally. Listen, this is going off. And look, what we're talking about
I'm sorry. I'm looking for
what we're talking
something
about,
that would destroy.
You can factually prove that I'm not wrong. All right, there is no guesswork involved here. What you've got right now, let's go back to the general staff. Let's go back to the war. The head of military intelligence, his name is Aviv Kochavi, made a remarkable statement not a month ago. It was in Herzliya. He said that Israel's enemies, and we're not talking Egypt, which supposedly is not the enemy, or Jordan, which is supposedly an ally. We're just talking the bad guys. Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, for now, no. Gaza have got 200,000 missiles pointed at the country. If you're the general staff, unless you threaten back and it scares the other side, scares the willies out of them, you don't exist for long. Now, look, the only thing I can think of, remember, let's say Israel survives the war. Is this a place you want to live? I mean, is this really what you want? Is this worth defending? You've got, again, some sort of threat that is preventing the war from breaking out right now. Something out there. And I've worked this out. And now I'm going to tell you I am guessing, and Prince Albert of Monaco has nothing to do with it. You've got a situation where the only way Israel could survive. You cannot, you know, I get these people, a lot of them Christians, let's nuke Damascus like it says in the Bible. You nuke Damascus, you may as well nuke yourself.
Yeah.
Damascus is 10 miles from the Golan Heights and 20 from the Galilee. You nuke Damascus, you just nuke the whole Upper Galilee. It's the silliest and stupidest thing I've ever heard, nuking Damascus. Then you nuke Beirut. Fine, you'll get, depending on where the wind is going, you'll finish off Haifa. Not to mention nuking Gaza. We don't even want to talk about that. We don't want to talk about the West Bank. The only time that this threat could be used is if Israel has no other options. And I believe this. Now, I'm guessing, but they have got to, they've got to have a kamikaze secret out there that if we go down, you go down with us. We'll explode the whole nuclear arsenal. 500 nukes will take you all down with us. Otherwise, Israel would have been toast by now.
Like Samson.
No, it's
yeah.
Like
pull down the temple around
Netanyahu saying there's no more hope, but we're not going to go down like with the Nazis. We're not going to be the only one.
Yeah. Well, that's the rumor, that if there was a nuclear war and it looked like, you know, our capital was going to be destroyed, that the United States would, is already targeted. This is just a rumor I've heard. Targeted every capital in the world.
No, you're not.
To bring them down so we're all equally
the intensity in Israel is so much higher than the likelihood of Washington getting nuked. I mean, we're looking at something Israel could not exist.
Yeah.
And listen, when I talk about Israel not existing, you think that's a joke? My son, my daughter, my sister, my nephew, my niece, my family, my friends, they're all in Israel.
And we're talking about a country the size of Maryland.
What does that mean? Well, we know it's
a very small country.
But again, back to what we said, the only way I see out of this, now let's say that, Azerbaijan Republic, and let's say the jets are ready, and I assume Iran is very ready now that this leak is out worldwide. I assume that these planes are going to fly into a halo of resistance, but neither here nor there. What I have been saying is that Israel can never attack Iran. It will be the end of Israel. That's what I've been saying. Well, I've been saying it for 5-6 years. Nukes or no nukes, the danger to Israel prevents them going into Gaza. You can launch 304 days at southern Israel, and Israel won't react. If they do react, at some point, it may not be tomorrow, the Arabs have patience, but if there are 200,000 missiles aimed all over Israel, the country can't survive that. And again, I'm going to repeat what I said. The only way is there's a threat out there. We go, you go. It's kamikaze time. That's what I think is going on in the deep background of the Middle East right now. There's a lot more, but I summarized it.
Yeah, I think you got it right, because that's kind of what I figured what was going on over there. And the two sides are, you know, always jousting with each other, you know, publicly. But, you know, behind the scenes, you know, Israel's got nukes. They're a little country.
Yeah, well,
Iran's a bigger country.
Power-wise, Israel's
and they
got
hate each
nukes.
Other.
Now, I'm going to say it again.
But,
Gaza should have been attacked to put an end to the ruckus. And Gaza is not attacked quite simply because something is going on. It's beyond the world condemning Israel. Israel has to get used to living under a rain shower, of the most sophisticated missiles. They haven't begun to take out the real good stuff. And I'm going to say something. You can put dirty nukes into a warhead. You can make Tel Aviv uninhabitable. There are all kinds of threats out there. Israel has them. The other side has them. So far, this is preventing another Holocaust. That's what it's preventing. And if you think I'm saying this lightly, I'm going to say it again. It's not lightly. I lived there for 33 years, and my family still do live there. They will all be victimized. I'm worried sick about this.
Well, I saw an article, I think of the Jerusalem Post a few months ago, that did talk about how naive the Christians were, because they said, from the Jewish viewpoint, you know, we look at your prophecies as if, you want your Jesus to come, but first you got to destroy Israel first. And, you know, Christians think they love Israel, but, you know, it's
well, we don't,
they don't understand the Jewish viewpoint, and that's one of the reasons why
I'm
doing.
Now, I'm going to say it again, it's complicated. And it involves Antelman, and it involves all kinds of stuff that your listeners have probably never heard before. But I think we did a good job today. Look, if you want my books, they're at lulu.com. That's www.lulu.com. You'll see a search box right in my name, Chamish. And my website is barrychamish.com.
Roll.
This is Jasa Sagonige,
a seventh-grade grandson of Sawanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault.
Inside the rainbow, look inside the heart. Kind of good.